Greetings. Happy New Year, everyone, and welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got a great show for you today. Sit back and relax. We'll be talking with Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor of The Nation, author of the new book, The Change I Believe In. We'll be talking about politics, past, present, and future. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
It's our tradition here at Media Minutes to wrap up the year with a countdown of some of the biggest media stories of 2011. We start with a saga that began in March when AT&T made a surprise $39 billion bid for T-Mobile. AT&T began to use its formidable lobbying power in Washington, spending nearly $12 million in the first half of the year. Approval of the merger seemed inevitable, even as consumer groups and media watchdogs weighed in against the deal, predicting lost jobs and higher prices.
As opposition mounted, a series of events dimmed the merger's once bright prospects. Nonprofit organizations and civil rights groups that had received money from AT&T were thrashed in the blogosphere and advocacy press for endorsing the merger, highlighting just how much weight and money AT&T was throwing around to gain favor with regulators and the public. In August, the Justice Department filed a lawsuit against the merger. In November, the Federal Communications Commission came out against the deal.
And on December 19th, the deal collapsed. This holiday story places some much-needed hope in everyday people's hearts. Sometimes government agencies actually do turn their backs on big power and money and act in the public interest.
In July, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals dealt a decisive blow against would-be media moguls, throwing out FCC rules that would have allowed one company to own a newspaper and a broadcast station in the same market. In what Free Press senior policy counsel Hori Wright called an absolute sweeping victory for the public interest, the court chastised the FCC for failing to consider the impact of the weakened rules on media ownership opportunities for women and people of color.
The FCC is now considering new rules as part of the media ownership review it conducts every 4 years. Wright said that the FCC should consider its mandate to protect the public interest and take into account the overwhelming evidence that media consolidation hurts the quality and quantity of news.
In April, internet activists were dismayed when the House voted to overturn the FCC's net neutrality rules, which the agency approved last December. Fortunes turned this November when the Senate rejected the resolution of disapproval of the FCC's open internet order and voted to uphold the commission's modest net neutrality rules. The vote sent a strong message to internet service providers that want to prioritize content and services on the internet. It left intact the FCC's ruling preventing ISPs from blocking or discriminating against internet users.
The Occupy Wall Street movement has been a source of inspiration to many of the 99%. As nonviolent actions challenging corporate power took place, cell phones, cameras, and Twitter messages documented the targeting of journalists by police. Since September, at least 36 journalists have been arrested while covering Occupy protests in 10 cities. 13 were arrested in just one day in New York City. Some were roughed up, tear-gassed, or pepper-sprayed. More than 40,000 people have signed a Free Press petition protesting the mistreatment of journalists, and hundreds more have called American mayors and urged them to rein in their police and defend freedom of the press.
In November, a hearing took place on a bill in Congress that could legalize internet censorship. The House's Stop Online Piracy Act and its companion in the Senate, the Protect IP Act, were written on behalf of the Motion Picture Association and the Recording Industry Association of America. SOPA would allow copyright owners to charge any websites hosting user-generated content with copyright infringement. No investigation of the charges would be required. Corporations would need only to file a notice, and the websites would be blocked, along with any associated ads. The bill would also allow banks to freeze financial deposits to the accounts of website owners. In a stacked deck, 5 out of 6 witnesses at the House hearing supported the bill. Several members of Congress have come out strongly against SOPA and PIPA, but Representative Lamar Smith, who is the lead sponsor of SOPA, is determined to bring the bill to a vote early in 2012. Meanwhile, the public outcry continues through petitions, letters, and phone calls.
And those are some of the big media stories of 2011. We'll be back next week with the latest news and media. Best wishes for peace and media justice in the new year. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Our guest today, Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, well known to our listeners, and author of a brand new book, The Change I Believe In, Fighting for Progress in the Age of Obama. Katrina VandenHeuvel, thank you for joining us today on Media Matters.
Thank you, Bob, for having me.
Well, I know how busy you are, and I'm glad you took time, and I want to let our listeners know we're recording this show in advance of January 1st, 2012. We're recording at the beginning of December. So the way history is moving so rapidly before us, some of what we talk about may be dated by the time we go on air. And let's just start, if we can, right away, Katrina, with the main theme of your book, as much as I can see it, which is, you know, how progressives and how you're dealing with the Obama administration in power and sort of the, I would use the term ambiguous relationship that you have and that liberals have and that the left has toward Obama. Do you think that's a fair characterization?
I think that's a fair characterization. I mean, what really is laced, the theme that unites the columns I write and the change I believe in, is the power of people's movements, the power of people's movements through our history to make fundamental change, to make transformational change. And it is that relationship to leaders in power, in my view, that has been so central. And that is part of, I think, the left progressive relationship with President Obama. I mean, Michael Kazin, the historian who's written a good book about the history of the left, the history of populism, has a line that goes something like, the left wouldn't be the left if it wasn't unhappy with President Obama. Because through time, as you know so well, Bob, the left's relationship with presidential administrations, with the White House, has been fraught. I mean, whether it was Roosevelt and his relationship with a more militant labor union, or LBJ, Lyndon Johnson and the civil rights movement. But I do think it's that synergy, that fusion, that relationship that is so key. And after all, I write this book also as editor of The Nation, which was founded in 1865 by abolitionists, a movement committed to ending slavery, and which in many ways, as our editorial board member Eric Foner has written so well about, played a role in moving President Lincoln in his position on slavery.
When you look at the Obama administration, understanding that he is a politician, the Democratic Party is enmeshed in the system itself. It's hardly an adversarial party towards the power in this country. It's part of the power structure. Allowing for all that, have you been disappointed nonetheless with the Obama administration?
I have been disappointed with our political system and with the Obama administration. And let me just, you know, take a minute to explain. I think this book is also partly about how fundamental change doesn't come about in 1, 2, even 3 elections. It doesn't come about because you have a new man or woman at the head of the country. It, you know, doesn't come about through a Superman or Superwoman who in a single bound can transform the whole mess our political system has become. I do think there are steps the Obama administration could have taken, particularly early on, before our system, already sort of corroded by corporate money, establishment power, has become even more congealed and corroded, to have taken steps to deal with an economic crisis, which was, as you well know, you know, comparable in 2008 terms to what the Great Depression was to this country, and to have taken steps to really show that it was more on the side of the people than on the side of the banks, and the way this administration bailed out the banks, and then failed to move forward with a series of steps, particularly looking back, not just at a stimulus, which was larded with tax cuts to get through a Congress with Republicans, but also to deal with the housing crisis, which continues to metastasize. So there's a sense of, yes, disappointment, but a sense of disappointment, Bob, with a system that needs to be, if I might use the word, smashed open, broken open, mm-hmm. by fundamental reform and by movements. And I think we're sitting here, and I know, you know, we're living through history, and every day in this country right now sort of seems to bring tectonic shifts that as we live through it, we may look back and think, wow, you even feel it as you live through it. But think of the new social movements evolving in our time, the Occupy Wall Street movement, broadly defined. I've come from a trip to the Pacific Northwest where there are encampments across that part of the country as there are across this entire country. And I think that movement has arisen for a number of reasons, and one of that has to do with the obscene inequality of our society, colliding with a sense of downward mobility, frustration, anger, a desire for fairness, but also it emerges out of a frustration with the Obama administration and a feeling that, we won't enough frustration with the mainstream media, which you write about so well, Bob, which has done such a great disservice to this country in these last couple years by basically telling the country, reporting to the country that there was one movement in this vast land, and that was the Tea Party. No. And I think Occupy Wall Street and its moving parts is saying with a resounding no, that is not the case. We are here, and we are going to stand with moral clarity for various important issues that have been off the radar of this country's national conversation for too long.
I want to talk. You just packed so much into that comment, Katrina. There's a whole book there, in fact. In fact, the first part of that book is your book, The Change I Believe In, by Katrina Vandenhoevel, our guest, just published by Nation Books. This is a pre-recorded show. Happy New Year, listeners of WILL. I'm Bob McChesney. Please don't call in today. Let Katrina Vandenhoevel and me do the yakking if we can. One point I want to get to, because you raised something very interesting, Katrina, I think, which is how when President Obama came in and the Obama administration, they took immediate steps, but somewhat halting steps to address the economic collapse and the economic crisis. Certainly not as bold as I think the Nation magazine would have liked in its pages, or most of the readers of the Nation would have liked. And I think we've often talked about the tactical problems there politically of not really giving the base something to sink its teeth into. But at the same time, it strikes me now as we look at the state of the world economy and we look at the foreclosure crisis and the various other issues, that the inability to give a really strong political response to the collapse in 2009 might actually have economic consequences. We might not have gotten all the way out of the woods.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, first of all, it's a fascinating moment, not just at the movement level, but we're sitting here as we may be heading into a, quote, endgame with the Eurozone, and that may have real impact on the U.S. economy and the election. And you see the Obama administration now playing a very direct role in that, talking about the use of the International Monetary Fund, pushing the Europeans to think of the European Central Bank in a way akin to what the Federal Reserve has been doing in this country in the last few years, buying up sovereign debt or buying up debt, easing the money supply. But I do think we may be on the verge of new bank failures. I mean, what the financial reform, and this is part of this ambiguity, Bob, I mean, that and the health care legislation. I mean, these are major lifts, major pieces of legislation, historic perhaps, but not at all commensurate with the scale of the crises they must address then or in these times. We may see again, because of the failure to restructure rather than simply resuscitate this hyper-financialized economy, more failures. And I think that is when we need to push very hard that there not be the same kind of bailout. And when I say bailout, we're not just talking, as your listeners probably know, about the TARP, $700 billion, but because of the work of good people inside Congress like Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, we're learning now more about how the Fed basically was an ATM machine at almost no interest, low interest rates for these huge financial institutions. And we're seeing a good judge, Judge Rakoff, telling the Securities Exchange Commission, you know, hell no, don't let Citigroup off with a slap on the wrist. Make it pay more than chump change for what it did to our economy, to millions of people. Finally, in my good state, New York State, Eric Schneiderman, the New York Attorney General, is working with a number of attorneys general, not enough to fight a deal the White House and attorneys general around this country want, which would again be a kind of slap on the wrist of big banks and not look at the underlying root problem of the securitization of mortgages. So there's a little bit of stand-up, and again, I think it's partly this moment where Occupy and its moving parts, there are others, labor unions, mortgage, you know, fairness fighters, people fighting for a living wage, people fighting for fairness and for holding these institutions which got us into this economic mess accountable. I think all of that is a wind at the back of some of what we are seeing. And one hopes a wind at the back of this administration to now speak more boldly about jobs and not fix on this misplaced obsession with debt and deficits as the crisis of our times. It's joblessness.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on January 1st, 2012, on WILL AM 580, based in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. We're talking about her new book, The Change I Believe In, Fighting for Progress in the Age of Obama, just released by Nation Books. Katrina VandenHeuvel, also the editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, a frequent guest, I'm glad to say, on Media Matters. Right now, we're talking about the economy. And, you know, one thing in your book, Katrina, you've got a lovely quote from Sarah Palin at one of the various Tea Party conventions, which is a quote you could have made, probably, about, you know, the corruption of giving bankers bailouts after they've destroyed the economy. And I'm wondering, what happened to that Tea Party?
Very interesting question. And I think you're right, Bob. I mean, the idea that there are some core issues on which, you know, an Occupy Wall Street movement, Tea Party movement, very, very different, with very different principles, could agree. And one of them is the sense of Wall Street running roughshod over people's lives. However, where I differ is in the belief that you need a government that isn't rigged against working people, the poor, the vulnerable, but a government that works for people and does regulate and hold in check these banks and Wall Street. And I think Sarah Palin and I would part on that. The Tea Party. Interesting. I'm sure you saw, you know, a few days ago, and I don't want to date us, but we're in the month of December, but that a report out showing the Tea Party losing some steam, losing its mojo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Tea Party, I believe, is both a mix of a kind of authentic grassroots movement fueled heavily by this astroturf corporate money, Koch brothers, et cetera. I think the overreach, Bob, I think a sense that, you know, the Tea Party has been out of sync with a majority view in this country, particularly around, you know, issues which are embedded in at this time in the psyche, in the lives and families' lives, like Social Security and Medicare. I mean, the famous line, was it in the summer, that hot summer of 2009 at the town halls,
mm-hmm.
where some Tea Party members said, stood up and shouted, keep government's hands off my Medicare. No, really, but in there you see something interesting, which is, one, a kind of low information at best sense of what government is doing in your lives, people's lives, but a sense also how embedded over these last 40, 50 years Medicare has become, so that it's not even viewed as a government program. But that deep hatred of government, that star of the beast, as anti-tax Darth Vader Grover Norquist talks about it, put that government in the bathtub, you know, drown it a little, strangle it, is embedded in a Tea Party vision, which for millions of Americans, as they struggle and may have a sense, again, government is rigged or not working for them, they still don't buy into the Tea Party vision. So I think it'll be interesting to see 2012. 2010, as I write in the book in a column, was not a mandate for the Tea Party. It was much more kind of, you know, toss the other guys out, the economy's rotten and lousy. It doesn't mean, as you said earlier at the very top of the program, that a Democratic Party establishment or the leadership or much of the Democratic Party has a strong alternative pathway. And that's, you know, that's something we need to think hard about and fight for. I would argue that I do believe that there are two, even three Democratic parties, and I'd agree with the late Senator Paul Wellstone, who spoke of the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, a line Howard Dean later picked up. But how to make that wing more powerful is a long haul.
Well, Katrina Van Heuvel, along those lines, I mean, the great issue for both of our adult lifetimes, in my case going back to the early 70s and years, a few years after that, has been this relationship of progressives to the Democratic Party and the sort of, you know, what the options are really. And when the choices are a Republican Party, which has become, since the 1970s, increasingly hostile to anything outside of fairly right-wing views, and a Democratic Party, which is much more comfortable in business than it had been during the Great New Deal era, you're sort of left being triangulated, in Bill Clinton's famous terms, or being played for someone who's at the receiving end of it. And, you know, it's been, how do you get out of that vicious cycle? Because it seems like in that context, politics are always moving to the right because you have no leverage to move them back.
It is I'm not sure it's vicious. It's extraordinarily frustrating, this sort of sense of the lesser of two evils living in that box. But on the other hand, I think at this stage, we need, one, to think anew about the possibility of third parties, but not in the sense of these third parties that Tom Friedman of the New York Times relentlessly writes about, this sort of top-down, Ross Perot, hedge-funded centrist. My view, Bob, I think we'd agree, is we have a centrist party in this country. It's a Democratic Party, certainly a large wing of it.
Yeah, let me interrupt you on that point, because this is something I've been kicking around. It strikes me that in most other advanced democracies, electoral democracies in the world, in Western Europe or even in East Asia, that a party like our Democratic Party would probably be a Christian Democratic Party in most of these other nations.
Absolutely.
And its main adversary would be to its left, not its right.
No, absolutely. But we do not have a parliamentary system. We are a poor country in the sparseness of our political parties, the major political parties. I mean, yeah, take a look. I mean, I'm not sure we want to look too hard at Germany right now at the center of what may emerge from the Eurozone crisis. I'm not sure it's played such a terrific role. But we do need, and I write in the book, there's a whole section on essentially the question of questions in my mind, how do we rebuild a beleaguered democracy? And in there are a set of, a passel of reforms that you and I know my great colleague, your great colleague, John Nichols, we've thought long and hard about how do you reform a winner-take-all system so you have a kind of ranked choice or proportional representation system. How do you find a way out of this grip of the Electoral College, which essentially makes only 18 or 19 states part of an election season? And how do you, the key thing, Bob, and one of the things I write about throughout this book, is how do we find a way, particularly as we come on the second anniversary of Citizens United, to find a way to get the corporate special interest money out of our system? We, in this sense, I have to say, you got to take the long view, but right now, it is a bleak view. I think you'd agree. We have really gone on a downward slide descent since post-Watergate, where there was a set of reforms that one could build on, whether it was clean money in the states, Arizona and Maine, or building on a presidential financing system, which seems to be unraveled. And President Obama was the first presidential candidate to withdraw both, I believe, in the primary and the general. And now you have a right-wing Supreme Court, which seems intent on unraveling the rest. So the fight, and again, Occupy Wall Street, but even before Occupy, the fight both for clean money legislation in the House and Senate, it's there to fight for that, but also to fight for an amendment strategy to overturn Citizens United, is one that has galvanized thousands and thousands and also become a plank in Occupy Wall Street in many encampments. And I think we may have to do that state by state. I sit in my good city, New York City, where we do have a good 1-to-6 matching program, small donations, public financing. But until we do that, Bob, the voices of ordinary people, the possibilities of untethering a Democratic Party from corporate money, and the possibilities of allowing all kinds of people to enter a political system who are truly progressive and rooted in movements as opposed to rooted in corporate cash will be very tough.
Our guest today, Katrina Van Heuvel, you've just been listening to. Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, author of the brand new book that we're talking about, The Change I Believe in, Fighting for Progress in the Age of Obama, just out with Nation Books. We're recording this program 3 weeks or so before January 1st, so don't call in today. Let us do the talking. And I think we've already been dancing around the Occupy movement, which I view as sort of an outgrowth and continuation of what began in Madison, Wisconsin in February of 2011. But really, the great political story of 2011 has been sort of the waking up of people who've been largely apathetic and uninvolved in politics for a very long time. And it seems like that, you know, where this is going to go, we don't know. But this is definitely the story I've been waiting for a long time.
You are absolutely right. And I, you know, first of all, it is the great political story of 2012. And you are absolutely right in going back to what happened in those extraordinary 57, 58 days in Wisconsin, in Madison. I write about it in the book. John Nichols, of course, our great seventh generation Wisconsinite, became the voice and the spirit
and body. From the wilderness, yes.
I know. But it was a sense of people, again, it was like occupying the State House, and a coalition, a great coalition of people, students, teachers, mothers with babies and strollers. You were there. I mean, you, firefighters. But it was a sense of people saying, enough. Because to me, Bob, so much of our politics, genuine, authentic, deep politics, comes from people's lived experiences. And here was a governor, Scott Walker, assaulting people where they lived, assaulting the rights of working people, and assaulting the possibilities of generations to live in decent, dignified ways. So I think coming out of Wisconsin, there was a lull, in a sense, though that energy continued on in ways that, again, a mainstream media didn't give enough attention to, but it sparked all kinds of movements and groups working across this country. And then Occupy has, you know, revived the sense of people in motion, as you put it. You know, as we sit here and talk, it's, you know, it's an evolving movement. To me, what's important in these next months is, first of all, you know, how we think of Occupy, in my mind, also needs to include what I call the 99% movement. It needs to include a constellation of good forces around Occupy doing their work. So this sense of, as someone put it the other day, a kind of benign octopus with tentacles, which with movements doing different things. You may have a movement working in more grounded ways, for example, to fight foreclosure evictions, or a movement which is recruiting and running 99% candidates. But I think Occupy needs to survive literally and metaphorically. I think Occupy, you know, the need to avoid the violence, maintain its wonderful nonviolent stance, even as it is confronted by police brutality, pepper spray around this country. Instead of fighting back, fight back so that there is a kind of MRI, laser-like look at the paramilitary policing that former Seattle Police Commissioner Norm Stamper wrote about in our pages. What kinds of reforms, how do we move out of that? And then I think there may be, maybe not leaders, because as you know, Bob, this idea of leaderlessness is so key to Occupy, but a clear, compelling voice, amplified, if not by a corporate media, which I worry will now focus more on division and conflict as opposed to the issues. So that's our work. And then to navigate that fork in the road between what I write about in my book, sort of the radicalism and idealism, and the grounded reformism, so that it can grow, go to where injustice is, and evolve, become a strongly radical evolutionary. I'm avoiding the word revolutionary because I think it's often, maybe this is my experience in Russia, fused with violence, which is not the case with Occupy. And I think the strongly radical evolutionary stance will be a very important one.
It's funny how the term revolution is used when conservatives use it to talk about the Reagan Revolution or something like that.
True.
It's the world's greatest word. It's like ice cream and pizza.
It's true.
But when someone on the left uses it, suddenly you're like marching people off to a firing squad.
I know, it's true. But I have to say, I think in the sense of, again, going back to the abolitionists, or as William Grider writes in The Nation last week, this wonderful editorial about the democratic promise of Occupy, he sees an Occupy, a link, something akin to the agrarian populists of the end of the 19th century, who were also confronting these powerful forces of the robber barons and the banks. So I think people come to Occupy, and I'm sure, you know, this may be the case for you, I don't know. We haven't had a chance to talk enough about it, but people are coming to Occupy with their own history, their own generational history. So there are a lot of people who come out of the New Left and the 60s, the anti-war movement. There are others who come out of Seattle. I was just there, by the way, and spoke of the WTO protests in 1999, who come out of that, and then come out of the anti-war movement against Iraq. So there's a whole, you know, we've seen people in motion, Bob. I know you know that. But it is, again, very exciting to see people again at this critical time.
You know, what's really exciting to me, Katrina, is, and this is something I've been researching with our mutual friend John Nichols for our forthcoming book, which is the decided and dramatic shift in the political attitudes of young people today compared to the immediately preceding generation. And it was this gaping difference now between Americans of all races and backgrounds, basically, between the ages of 18 and 29 and their elders. And you know, I think one of the things that's striking is how much more politically progressive, sympathetic to progressive ideals, liberal values they are than predecessor generations, and how much more willing they are to do something new because they don't like where the things are going now.
You know, I want to believe that. I'm always, and you and John obviously have been studying this, I'm always worried about overgeneralizing about a generation, because I do think we see clearly on social, important social issues, which obviously have an economic underpinning, like on gay marriage, on even on immigration. But I worry sometimes about how the media has so distorted the ideas, for example, of Social Security. So you may still see some of that generational rift, which shouldn't be there in terms of economic issues. My sense of a younger generation, and I see this through the Nation interns, we have about 30 strong each year. There's a there are quite a few there's a libertarian cast among some of them, and some of that's great. I mean, you see it in the interest in legalizing marijuana, in finding ways to live in more tolerant ways without a government looking out over your personal lives. And then, of course, the overlay we haven't talked about of the new media, the social media, the technologies that have fueled these movements and that are, if not second nature for a younger generation, it's just embedded in their life in critical ways, which is exciting for the most part.
Well, you know, I think the data I've seen, it doesn't go issue by issue, and a lot of it's based on voting, and some of it's on opinion polling on issues of the economy. And so you're obviously using sweeping generalizations whenever you make those characterizations, but it's just the general difference in opinion across age groups that just leaps out in a way that wasn't the case at all 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. And it's a long-term trend line. It's really started in the early or mid-90s, and it's just been moving in one direction.
Interesting. I mean, part of my, part of the book, The Change I Believe In, is the expectations were so great for President Obama, especially, it seems to me, for a younger generation of voters who came in for the first time, voted for the first time, and who saw for the first time electoral politics as a vehicle for change. And you know how complicated that is, because there have been generations of young people, certainly a New Left, in the 60s, did not see electoral politics as a vehicle for change. And I think a younger generation also, because so new, saw in what Obama was saying the possibility of quick change. Now, it's true, as you go back and you read President Obama's, candidate Obama's speeches, it was more about hope and about how he represented the embodiment of change, but it was also about how we can make change, the community organizer speaking. And one of the kind of more intangible disappointments, Bob, is, of course, you can't bring a movement into the White House, and a real movement shouldn't be in the White House. But there was a sense among millions, particularly young people, that President Obama almost demobilized this nonviolent electoral army at his back, which could have been wind at his back as he fought for reforms, and instead went quite technocratic.
I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, went inside the the Beltway and into these legislative battles without coming out to speak to people and explain or mobilize.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think the from my personal experience and from giving lots of talks around the country to young people, it's fair to say that the demoralization by the end of 2009 and certainly ever since and through 2010 was stunning among young people. I mean, just the sort of the extraordinarily dismay at what hadn't happened at all and sort of being left out of the picture. And, you know, one of the things that was interesting, Katrina, was that one survey saw that the 18 to 29-year-old voting group, there 51% of that group voted, eligible voters voted in 2008, and only 21% in 2010. It was just an enormous drop-off.
Yeah, say that it was 51 and then 20?
21.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was.
To be fair, in congressional, not off your presidential elections, you do get a drop, but not like that is quite stunning.
Well, also, I think that there's a lot of stuff here that suggests you have to look at sort of historically rare elections for 2008 rather than to sort of business as usual elections, and that there was a lot in play besides just the usual drop off.
Right. Absolutely.
Our guest, Katrina Vandenhoevel. This is Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. Coming to you January 1st, 2012. We're recording this show, so please don't call in. Katrina Vandenhoevel, the editor and publisher of The Nation magazine and author of the brand new book, The Change I Believe In, Fighting for Progress in the Age of Obama, series of articles you've written both for the Washington Post website, which you write for, and also for your Director's Cuts or Editor's Cuts
that you write at thenation.com.
At thenation.com, and people can go to thenation.com, find your work and the work of all the other writers for The Nation. It's really a must-go-to bookmark website now, I think, for people who are interested in politics in the United States. Whatever their viewpoints, it's a place you have to go to follow stuff. You know, let's turn over to the political right in this country, and it's sort of a we're speaking here at the beginning of December, and the Republicans are in the midst of their nominating process for president, and it's getting in a ton of media coverage, obviously. I mean, more than imaginable, probably more than all other political coverage combined times 10. And, you know, what's your impression so far of what's taken place in 2011 on the Republican side?
Cruelty. An attempt to roll back the civilizing advances of our time. No, I mean, I sit here today, and I mean, I just looked at thenation.com, which I read all the time, and John Nichols, who has been writing about Newt, not the reptile Newt Gingrich, the Newt Gingrich boomlet in the seems but anybody but Romney Republican cycle, you know, has come up with another thumper of a cruel point. I mean, no, really, the other day he basically said that poor kids don't know work unless it's crime. And he, you know, he has essentially a week earlier, a few days earlier, called for the repeal of child labor laws and suggesting that janitors be fired in schools and children be brought in to replace that job. I think we see a party which is not conservative if you take the philosopher Edmund Burke's idea of conservatism to heart. It is an extremist party that is the culmination of what Bill Moyers wrote about in The Nation a couple weeks ago, which is the culmination of a 40-year right-wing march through the institutions, where we see the anti-tax mania taken to the highest level. We see a belief that the very policies that got us into this economic crisis and mess are, they believe, the answer out, our solution, more cuts for the richest, cuts for corporations, more deregulation, more privatization. I also see a party enthrall to anti-science views. Why is that important? Because I think the climate crisis issue is one of the, you know, it's one of the central crises of our time, and they basically deny it. And they do so, I would argue, maybe a few of them have strong beliefs. I doubt it. I think a lot of it is the corporate money that has come into this party. And finally, Bob, I mean, not that the Democrats in any way are to be excused in this realm, but something you and John have been thinking hard about, which is, I believe, the silent candidate in this entire campaign, particularly in the Republican Party, is the one we need to fix on, which is these super PACs, these new vehicles for undisclosed, unregulated money, largely as a result of the Citizens United decision, but the money that is going to metastasize and pollute our system. And we will learn more about these candidates from those vehicles than we will from the actual campaigns.
Yeah, I mean, we're actually in, I think, a post-traditional journalism campaign mode now, and I think most races are either completely uncovered or so superficially covered that journalism is irrelevant.
And I think, as you and John have written about, and I know you're writing more about this for a book, but, you know, people are learning more about campaigns from negative, mostly negative advertising, which continues to flood the airwaves, certainly in the 19 or 20 battleground states, than they do from their local journalism. And that's a very scary prospect. And in addition, these debates, relentless. I mean, I'm all for debates. But, I mean, they become infomercials, in a sense.
They're, yeah.
You know, you question, and again, we've all written, you've written brilliantly about this, but it really exposes the obliteration of the line between news and entertainment. You wonder, as you watch, which division of these corporate behemoths is running these debates, the entertainment or news?
No, it's like real-world, you know, Republican Party. it's really quite extraordinary.
Get me off the island. I want to be a survivor.
I think the ratings will probably go up as a result. Maybe not the ratings they want to get, but they're certainly getting more attention than anything I've seen in a while. And, you know, that leads to one of the great developments in American media in the last two decades, and I think something that the nation has wrestled with and dealt with, has been the rise of right-wing talk radio, Rush Limbaugh being the exemplar, and Fox News, especially on television now, the cable news channel. And, you know, what's your sense of the role they play currently in American politics? Should they be taken seriously? How do we deal with them and understand them better?
You know, I have to tell you, I don't treat Fox News as a news enterprise. I mean, it works so closely hand in hand with the Republican Party, and has given a voice to birthers and anti-Islamic, anti-immigrant hate mongers. And we've learned, and I don't know if you saw this the other day. I was interested. It's in the evolution of a kind of media trend, but that so many of these Republican candidates no longer do, quote, retail politics. They're not going into towns and meeting with people in coffee shops. And all of that, I think, is so valuable. People hear firsthand in their living rooms, maybe sometimes too often it's a fundraiser, but still, it's retail politics. Instead, candidates now trot into town, go to the local Fox outlet or a right-wing radio station. So they're being mediated, you know, and they're being sort of puffed up and pampered, in a sense, not being exposed to real-life people.
Yeah,
have you seen that trend?
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that's part of the other side of the coin of the big money and the collapse of journalism is that the right-wing media is there for those candidates, and with the big money, it's easier just to do a blitzkrieg of advertising than it is to actually do retail politics.
Right, and that's again, it is as so much linked to the money, as you said, but it's corrosion of an already beleaguered democracy because people now don't hear, if they have the time, they're not even hearing much directly. It's all trend-mediated.
You know, understood that way, Katrina Vandenhoevel, in a way, I've been thinking about this with the Occupy movement, and before that, the Wisconsin and Ohio uprisings earlier
in
the year.
Yeah, Ohio was very important,
But in a way, it strikes me that they're really the constitutional option Jefferson particularly anticipated with, you know, things like the right freedom of assembly and the First Amendment, that there was an understanding, at least among Jefferson especially, that no matter how well designed a democratic system is, it was always going to be prone to corruption, tyranny, and that you had to have an escape valve within the system for people to work outside the system to raise hell.
Absolutely.
And that's really what's going on now.
Absolutely. And I think more of it is needed. And just, I mean, again, in traveling on the road a little these last few days, each community has an Occupy encampment and organizations around it that are very much part of the character of that community. And it's very much there where you see that freedom of assembly. But I was in Portland, and that night there was going to be a vigil at the State House to protest some of the budget cuts coming down. And it was there where you had central labor councils. You had a coalition, which, by the way, had just passed this past year, a first sick payday leave, third city in this country, if you can believe, for something so important and so modest in a way. But you're seeing the possibilities of that in squares, in parks, in state houses. And that is what, you know, that is what we hope to see more of.
Well,
that's what, and Ohio was a measure of that too, where people actually, again, there was wind at the back because of Occupy, but you had, as you well know, labor, community groups, faith groups, teachers working very hard in democratic ways, small d democratic ways, to counter Governor Kasich's attempt again to assault the rights of working people. And it was a victory, and it was quite resounding. And I don't know where the recall in your good state stands, but my sense is there's enormous energy there in the terms of numbers of signatures that have been gathered.
Well, we're not recalling quite here in Illinois yet, but up in Wisconsin.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's quite all right.
I keep thinking,
it's a sister state here, so we're
Illinois is going to be next. No, but in Wisconsin, don't you think the energy there is just, you know, it's very powerful?
No, and I think you're right. There's something there, and that's what's so exciting and interesting about these times and making them very special. And I think you also get a sense of this, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, when you look at how the Republican Party and the mainstream discourse in the Democratic side as well has completely sort of understood that this has tapped into something enormous that they had been ignoring. And so this notion of 1%, 99%,
right.
is now everyone understands they've got to talk about that intelligently or they're going to be dismissed as not getting it at all.
That's right. And I mean, I think there is also obviously concern about that important term being taken lightly or co-opted, but that to me is secondary to the value of that idea.
Did you see the thing with Frank Luntz
not
too long ago? Well, Frank Luntz, the great Republican pollster and sort of spinmeister, sort of did a seminar for Republicans on how to deal with the Occupy movement. It was published in December 1st or the last day in November. And it got a lot of attention at the time. And what was striking was he said that conservatives and Republicans for now should never use the term capitalism.
Because
capitalism connotes to people immorality and greed and unfairness. So that now they can only use the term like free market enterprise, or, you know, something like that, or sort of free economy, something like that.
That's so interesting.
And, you know, that is a dramatic shift. You know, Milton Friedman, they proudly wore the banner of capitalism. Ronald Reagan proudly wore it. I mean, it was worn proudly until 2011. And now suddenly their polling tells them that term is a clunker.
That is fascinating. I mean, the problem, you know, the nation did, I think, a strong issue called Reimagining Capitalism with William Grider.
Yes, indeed.
I mean, there are different kinds of capitalism. And we live with crony capitalism. We certainly don't live with a free market. So they may turn to that term, but within there too. But that is a fascinating development, and much deeper and broader than, for example, Representative Eric Cantor moving quickly from one week saying Occupy Wall Street made up of mobs to saying, yes, we need to look at the disparities of income in our country. But very interesting. I will look at that.
But I think one of the interesting things that we've forgotten, because we haven't had popular movements like this since the 60s, early 70s, is how much when people do raise hell, even if they're not in power, they can force people in power to pay careful attention to them.
Absolutely.
And we're getting a dose of that right now as we speak. Katrina Vandenhoevel, our guest today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you January 1st, 2012. Again, this is a pre-recorded show, so please don't call in. Let us do the yak, and we've only got a few minutes left. And Katrina Vandenhoevel, the editor of The Nation and the publisher of The Nation, also the author of the brand-new book, The Change I Believe in, Fighting for Progress in the Age of Obama. Another hat you wear, Katrina Vandenhoevel, among many. And a hat I always like to talk about, because I don't think you get the time to devote to this that you probably would like, is Eastern European politics, something that gets virtually no coverage in the United States anywhere. And so most Americans, most of my students have no idea about it. It's fallen off the world map since 1990 or so.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, it's such an important part of the world, and so important to everywhere in our future, and important in its own right, obviously. Could you just tell us, you know, what's going on in Russia today, and what are the trends there, and what should people who care about following the world be looking at there?
I was in Russia a few weeks ago, and I think what's important to look at there is the fact that you have a rise of right-wing nationalism in Russia that we're also seeing across Eastern Europe, and some of that is fueled by the economic circumstances. Some of that is by the ongoing wars in Chechnya. But you have December 4th, you have a parliamentary election. It's, I think I'm fair to predict now that the party in power, the United Russia Party, will win, but not by the margins it had hoped. Putin has announced he will once again be president, and it is almost certain he will be, with Medvedev, his partner, as prime minister. And I think you're going to see in Russia a de-democratization, both economically and politically.
And that's not really a big dissent to begin with, is it?
Well, it is, because as I sit here, I'm going to the office to edit Mikhail Gorbachev's piece for the Nation's issue on the 20th anniversary of the end of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And I write in my book, I have a few columns about Gorbachev. But what he did in the period from 85 to 91 was virtually unprecedented in Russian Soviet history, which was to begin to open up a system, to end the censorship, to try and democratize. And though many argue he should have found a way to end the, to split the Communist Party and form another party, because he essentially is a social democrat, that he should have done that earlier before the coup, which then led to the end of the Soviet Union, he opened up a country. And I think it's very important for your listeners to know that Yeltsin came in, he was a hero in the West, but in many ways he opened the country to the greatest fire sale of the 20th century, where we saw the rise of the oligarchs who continue to grip Russia, and the wealth of the country is so much in their hands. A mini oligarch in Russia today is worth about $6 billion, so put that in your cap.
It's extraordinary. The inequality there is, it makes us look like small-timers.
Yeah, and the interesting part is I did talk to a number of good friends there, people of the left, and the Occupy Moscow, Occupy Russia movement is not moving in many ways, because it's the oligarchs, one of them is, in my view, wrongly, the Russian persecution of Khodorkovsky has made him a martyr. He sits in a prison camp. But the larger trend line is the need for, you know, there are small movements around the country. And just briefly, the first thing Putin did when he came to power in 1999 was to give Yeltsin and his family immunity from prosecution for corruption. I think that's important to know, because in how a system is conceived or how someone comes to power is how we see the rule. So there's continuing oligarchical grip. On the other hand, the economic situation for the moment, for most people, they're getting pensions, they're getting paid. And just on the movement front, what interests me is there's quite a bit of active labor activity around the country. There were some strikes. And as a journalist, the print press remains fairly free. I could make the argument that in Moscow on any given day there is a broader spectrum of views than in my city, New York City. The circulations aren't as high as they were during the Russia-Soviet period. And the internet, unlike in China for the moment, is very vibrant. That may change, but you can go on there and see Putin as Hitler, or you can see a man named Alexei Navalny, who is this great corporate whistleblower, way too nationalist for some people, but who's posting corporate documents exposing fraud at big outfits and has a real following. And he is someone well-known to millions of Russians. So there's quite a bit going on, and we'll see where it goes. But it's important, I think, also just in Afghanistan, if I could conclude there.
Please
that,
do.
You know, the Russians have been central in opening all these routes for American forces. But never forget that Gorbachev came to power in 1985. And he had a military-industrial complex, but he also had generals who understood that the war in Afghanistan was unwinnable by military means. It took 4.5 years to get out, but he understood that the need to salvage his domestic reforms was contingent, and it was key to get out of Afghanistan. And I think that's something we in this country need to focus on, because we now have a national security industrial terrorism complex that is very dangerous to our prospects of rebuilding our country, to our democracy. And these wars must be resolved, ended, and the conflicts resolved by political means. This war in Afghanistan is not winnable, and I think the country has seen that, has turned against this war, and we need to remember that, because part of the economic crisis, not only Bush tax cuts, the economic recession, but two unfunded wars that have not made us more secure.
And, you know, I think that in the case of the Obama administration and its conduct in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, to the untrained eye, it seems like it's pretty much a continuation of the Bush administration.
Well, he President Obama has started the movement out of Iraq, but in Afghanistan there was grave disappointment that there was an escalation as opposed to a de-escalation. But I think the real disappointment, Bob, is on the executive power front, where a president, once given these powers, is loath to discharge them. But I'm thinking of the failure to truly confront the abuses and excesses of the Bush-Cheney era in the realm of detention.
You know, we had Glenn Greenwald on the show a few weeks ago talking about his new book, Injustice for Some, and he makes that argument as well as anyone has.
No, he's been at the forefront of a voice of conscience. But it is, you know, Jeremy Scahill at The Nation has been fearless in his reporting on the continuation of secret sites, the danger of targeted, and immorality of targeted assassinations, the drone warfare. You know, I think we live at a time when our laws have been surpassed by technology, so that one could see an administration. Well, you had Harold Coe, a man who wrote a great book on the national security constitution, twist himself into pieces in order to argue that going into Libya was consistent without having to abide by the War Powers Resolution Act, and some of that is because we have this technology of drone warfare. But anyway, we need a new, there's a big chapter in my book on toward a new national security and the possibilities offered up by the Arab uprisings to realign a foreign policy so it's not tethered to the most oppressive national security intelligence forces in countries, but is more in sync with the aspirations of people for better lives, for more legitimate and non-corrupt governments, and a life of dignity and decency.
Katrina Vandenhoevel, I know you've got to run in a second, so if we could conclude, I'd just like to go back to The Nation magazine, where you are the editor and publisher, and you've been the editor now, I think. Gosh, you're approaching two decades at this point, aren't you?
1995.
Yeah, so it's 16 years now.
Hard to believe.
And there's another big, on your 20th anniversary as editor and publisher, and I hope that day will come for you, there will also be the 150th anniversary of The Nation. And just wondering, what sort of celebrations do you have in mind?
Well, one thing we are already starting is the great filmmaker, documentary filmmaker Barbara Koppel has started a film about The Nation in these last decades to come out and mark our 150th. And we are planning a whole set of meetings and gatherings around this country, and we're going to have a whole set of celebrations in New York City, our home city for 146, will be 150 years. So we are already plotting and planning. And, you know, some of it, though, as you know, Bob, if we had spent a lot of time planning what we would commit a set of panels and celebrations to prior to Occupy Wall Street in this exciting moment when people are now in motion. A year ago was a grim period. Now there's a sense more of possibility. So we are hewing closely to time while planning for the long term with the 150th.
Well, Katrina Vandenhoevel, thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to join us
today. Oh, thank you, Bob. Thank you. And I look forward to seeing you soon. And look forward to your writing and your...
I do, too. I'm looking forward to my co-author's writing. Katrina Vandenhoevel is the author of The Change I Believe In, Fighting for Progress in the Age of Obama. Thank you again, Katrina.
Thank you.
All right. And listeners, I want to thank Mike Pritchard for engineering today's show for me in advance. And everyone, have a great week, and we'll be back 1 week from today with another guest. Happy New Year.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This week's Wait Wait might actually be good for you. It's a special health show with enjoyable new diseases, innovative diet techniques, entertaining side effects, and Dave Barry complaining about his toilet. If our show lasts more than 4 hours this week, call your doctor. Join us for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday morning at 10 and Sunday afternoon at 3 on AM 580. This is Illinois Public Media.